Hello and welcome. I'm Lori Hardy. Thanks for listening in as we continue to talk with leaders in our community. Joining me today, I'm so excited, is the CEO of Life Center Northwest, Kevin O'Connor. Their logo is working together to save lives through organ and tissue donation. And I love this mission statement. A future where no one dies on the organ transplant waiting list. High quality tissue grafts are available to all in need. Every donor and donor family is honored and all employees are inspired and empowered to realize their highest potential in service of our mission. Thank you for joining us. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Life Center Northwest?
Sure. Life Center Northwest is a nonprofit organization. Our mission is, as you described, we exist to help people in need of replacement organs and tissues. And we also work with families of patients who die and can become organ and tissue donors and eye donors to help them through their navigate that process at the time of their loved one's death, be able to leave with a sense of having a legacy from their loved one who's actually had the opportunity to save and heal other people's lives through their gift of life. Throughout the Pacific Northwest, including the entire state of Alaska, all of Montana, most of Washington State, and the northern nine counties of Idaho. And we work with every hospital in those four states every time there's an opportunity for organ, tissue, or eye donation.
Wow. And here you're located right in my building.
Yes, we are.
Okay. I've seen people in the elevator with coolers and things.
We do periodically have blood specimens or tissues or even occasionally kidneys that are being transported from the donor hospital to a transplant center here in Seattle.
Wow.
Or elsewhere, a transplant center outside of Seattle.
Now, I have, since I was, I think, 11, I got contacts, and I was going in for a contact appointment. I lived on Whidbey Island, and we had to go all the way to Anacortes. Mm-hmm. And they called just before we left, and they said, hey, don't come in. Doctor has to do an eye transplant.
Sure.
And my mom was like, oh, freaked out. I mean, I was fascinated. And from that moment on, I wanted to give anything away I could when I passed. And I was so glad when the driver's license thing came out, because then nobody had to guess. They would know right away
that
was my plan. Can we talk a little bit about myths?
Mm-hmm.
And I know one of them, because I would always tell anyone who would listen that I wanted to be an organ donor. And they would say, oh, if they know you're an organ donor, they're not going to try and save your life if you get in a bad car accident.
Right, sure. Well, we know that that's a belief that some people have. But in reality, the healthcare team in the emergency room and in the hospital is not aware of someone's desire to be a donor or not be a donor. That information only becomes available much further along in the hospital stay if and when the patient reaches a point where any further attempts to salvage them would be unsuccessful. And at that point, it can be determined whether or not they had previously indicated their wish to help others through organ, tissue, and eye donation.
That is really good to know. Yeah. That's my new answer.
There you go.
What are some other myths?
Well, I think there are some myths that there are major religions that are opposed to organ and tissue and eye donation. And again, that is absolutely not factually correct. All major religions throughout the world are supportive of organ, tissue, and eye donation, really as being the final act of altruism and generosity and helping your fellow humans as you depart this planet. That's another myth that I think can be debunked.
What is organ and tissue donation, and why is it so important?
Right. Well, I think, you know, much of the attention in the media goes to solid organ donation, so kidney transplants, liver, heart, lung, et cetera. But there are many, many more people who are waiting for a replacement tissue graft. So that might be some sort of connective tissue to help restore their function after, say, a sports injury or traumatic injury. Nowadays, it's possible to transplant nerves, corneas, heart valves, skin, bone, connective tissue, pericardium. The list goes on and on. And so many people out there who aren't necessarily at risk of dying, but whose life and health would be substantially improved with this ability to receive a tissue graft can benefit from tissue donation. But I do want to say, with respect to organ donation, there are well over 100,000 people in the United States today who are waiting for that phone call that there's been an organ located for them. And most of those patients are actually waiting for replacement kidneys. Those are patients with end-stage renal disease whose kidneys have stopped working. So in order for them to continue to be alive, they need to be on dialysis. And of course, it's far preferable to receive a kidney transplant. That way, you're no longer chained to dialysis.
Yeah.
Your quality of life improves, as does your probability of surviving for a longer period of time.
Can you be alive and donate tissue?
No, tissue donation. We talk about there's two types of donors. There's a deceased donors, which is what we're talking about in the case of tissue donation. And there's living donors. And of course, there's a growing number of people who, for a variety of reasons, all in the interest of helping others, sometimes people they know, sometimes people they don't even know, can donate one of their kidneys, for example, since we have two kidneys. So last year, there were about 7,500 kidneys transplanted from living donors. So the donors of those organs are still alive and well today. They just have one less kidney than they did a year before.
And is that a real lifestyle change for them?
There's a growing body of knowledge about the outcomes for those patients. And they actually do... on the whole, do really quite well. We are fortunate in some cases to have more than one organ. And in this case, most adults can get by quite well and have the same lifetime experience and quality of life and health, whether they have one kidney or two kidneys.
Facebook now, you're seeing more of that where people, you know, someone at the coffee shop gave a kidney. Right. And I think that it's so great when they tell those stories, because in the past, you've always thought, well, it's when you die. So to think we can be a living donor is wonderful.
Absolutely.
So you told us how many people are waiting for a life-saving organ. You said 10,000?
No, over 100,000. About close to 120,000 are waiting.
Wow.
Today, over 2,000 waiting here in the Pacific Northwest.
Really?
Yeah. Right. So we take our mission very seriously at Life Center Northwest. And I mean, we every day, without exception, 24/7, 365, we're focused on one thing and one thing only, and that's helping as many people as we can in need of replacement organs, replacement tissues, and replacement corneas. Mm-hmm. And so that's what really sort of keeps us going. We're inspired by the donors and their families, and we're inspired by the patients who are willing to undergo those operations to get a second chance at life and renewed health.
Does everything go through Life Center? So like if I had a friend that needed a kidney and I wanted to help them, would we come to you first? Or how does that work?
No, actually, no. We are the intermediary between the transplant programs that perform the organ transplants and the donors who are located in the donor in hospitals. We refer to them as donor hospitals. So for example, there may be a large metropolitan trauma center where a patient comes in after a motor vehicle accident, and they may have a non-survivable head injury. In that instance, they would the hospital would contact Life Center Northwest, and then we would send a team out and take it from there up to the point of where we transfer the organ to the transplant program. But if somebody wanted to be a living donor, they could reach out to any one of their local kidney transplant programs, and that information is available to them through a number of websites, including the United Network for Organ Sharing website, which is unos.org.
UNOS.org.
Correct.
How does the organ donation process work?
Sure. It's a great question. So as I said, unfortunately, most people who end up being deceased organ donors, their death was unexpected. Unlike many people who die in this country after a period of time, sometimes months or even years, with the knowledge that they're slowly dying, patients who become deceased organ donors generally left their home in the morning not expecting to not return. And so these are patients who suffer either traumatic injuries from motor vehicle accidents or other head trauma, or patients who have a non-traumatic but non-survivable brain injury, like a stroke, for example. A growing source of organ donation are patients who have cardiac arrest outside of the hospital setting. They're resuscitated in the field, but they come to the hospital, and unfortunately, the lack of oxygen to their brain renders their brain not salvageable, and they're declared brain dead.
Oh, interesting. And I know next month is National Heart Month.
Right, Donate Life Month. Actually, it would be April.
Oh, April
Now,
is okay.
Next month, there may be something related to the heart as well in February.
But April
It's Valentine's Day month.
Right. Yeah, so. And so April is like Donate Everything Month.
Right.
Is that awareness?
Yes,
then you're coming back in April.
I would be happy to.
And who is eligible to be an organ, eye, and tissue donor?
Yeah, again, that's a great question. And the answer is that is very dynamic and changing all the time. So if you were to ask me this question, say 10 years ago, I would have responded in a way that would have limited the number of people who could be donors. Whereas today, we're actually looking at things like age. We don't treat as a fixed limit anymore. So somebody up to the age of 75, 80, even 85, if all else was within normal in terms of their organ function, they could be considered a suitable organ donor,
really?
At least for some organs, especially livers. Livers can be recovered and transplanted from patients in their 80s, and they can do quite well. For tissue, again, the so-called maximum age or the criteria by which we select in or out donors are continuing to increase. There was recently a study that looked at compared the outcomes of cornea transplants for when the donor was between the age of 65 and 75 compared to donors under age 65. And the results over 5 years were really identical. As we learn more, as we expand the margins, and today really there's very few what we would call absolute contraindications or reasons why somebody couldn't at least be considered a potential organ, tissue, or eye donor.
And what's the best way to let somebody know you want to be a donor? Is it the driver's license or?
Right. Well, I think, first of all, it's really important that your loved ones know of your intent. I mean, that makes all the difference in the world. But in addition to that, you can now register your intent to be a donor through online donor registry. That serves as legally binding permission to proceed with your donation. So in an ideal world, your loved ones who would be with you at the time of your death are well aware that you wanted to be a donor. And in addition to that, you are in the donor registry. That would be the ideal situation. But absent that, you can go to lcnw.org for Life Center Northwest. When you get to our homepage, on the upper right-hand corner, there's a link that says register here. And anybody can go online and do that in a matter of minutes.
How long have you been doing this?
35 years.
Okay. Say the last even 10 years. What have you seen as the biggest change or difference?
Yeah, well, I think a few things have changed, and it's really exciting. One is that the technology that we use to preserve the organs from during that period when they've been removed from the donor and have not yet been implanted in the recipient, we're moving to much more dynamic ways of preserving the organs, so we can actually have organs preserved during that interval at normal body temperature and allow them to continue to function outside of the body so that we can evaluate whether or not they would work well in the transplant recipient. And that's a huge step forward. 10, 15, 20 years ago and earlier, we really, once the organ was removed, it was put on ice in sterile conditions, obviously, and we didn't have any opportunity to learn anything more about that organ during that preservation time. But now we can actually observe the organ's function and see whether or not it's improving or if the function is declining. That helps make better decisions about whether or not organs should be used. The ultimate goal here is to help people, and the way we help them is replace their diseased organ with a healthy organ that will prolong their life and let them return to a relatively normal lifestyle.
Yeah. As far as the people waiting, mm-hmm. how does that work? For instance, if you're on the top of the list and you live in New York and somebody donates here on the West Coast.
Right. Well, in general, organ allocation policy distributes organs within a reasonable geographic proximity.
Oh, okay.
Now, there are exceptions to that, but all else being equal, most of the organs from, say, the New York City area would stay on the eastern part of the country. That's not to say all of them would. And there's an evolution in allocation policy towards broader geographic sharing. Because as the technology improves, what I just described to you, the ability to preserve organs for a longer period of time, that opens up new opportunities for us to share organs more broadly. And ideally, we would direct the organs to the patients who are in the most need medically, and also would have the best likelihood of having a long and healthy life after the transplant. And so new technologies, innovations in organ preservation, changes to allocation policy are all moving us in that direction of being able to distribute the organs virtually anywhere in the United States.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Now, I heard this podcast, person who's trying to create drones.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there's some very early experience with actually doing that. I know there was the first successful transport of a kidney happened in Baltimore, Maryland last year at some point.
Really?
And the organ was placed in a sterile container, secure in a drone, and that drone was directed from the donor hospital rooftop to the transplant center rooftop, and where it was picked up by the team, brought to the operating room, and the patient did quite well. So there's no question, just like we'll see more and more use of drones for other things like package delivery, mm-hmm. there's no doubt in my mind that drones will be one of many innovations that will loom large in the future of organ donation and transplantation.
Boy, that is so fascinating. What would you say to someone who has thought about it, they're a little bit skeptical?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think it's helpful for people to understand the facts, which are the opportunity to be considered to be an organ and tissue donor is relatively rare. Not everyone who dies can be a tissue donor, because one thing is you an organ and tissue donor because you need to die within the hospital setting.
Oh.
And people, I don't think necessarily are aware of this, but last year we had close to 3 million people die in the United States, but under 1 million of them died in the hospital setting. So right there, it's only 1 in 3 chances that at the time of your death you'll even be in a hospital. And if you're not in a hospital when you die, you won't be able to be an organ donor.
Really?
That's number one. Number two is you have to have that type of non-survivable brain injury, either traumatic or non-traumatic, in order to be eligible for consideration. So to even be considered as a potential organ donor is very rare, less than 2 in 1,000 deaths are able to be considered for donation. So if you should find yourself in that situation, the knowledge that you can actually provide life to many, many other people, life and improved health through both organ donation and tissue and cornea, improved vision. I mean, imagine someone whose sight is restored. I mean, it's incredibly to think about being able to make that kind of a change in somebody's life. I really think there's very few people walking on this earth who would choose, if they knew what so much good could come from their choice, they would choose not to do that.
Explain to me the reason, which this is new to me, that if you don't die within the hospital setting, they can't use.
Right. Well, once death has occurred, once your circulation has stopped, your organs and tissues begin to deteriorate. And so in order for us to be able to have the short time frame that we need to recover the organs and tissues while they are still, you know, biologically viable, patients need to be in a hospital setting.
What about in the ambulance?
Well, if you're in an ambulance on the way to a hospital, that would be okay.
That counts. Okay. And I just want to revisit again, because I think it's really important what you said in the beginning when we were talking about myths, that people, and I'm talking to Kevin O'Connor with Life Center Northwest, and what people think, oh, they won't save me if they know I'm an organ donor. And tell me your answer to that again, because I just want to make sure if somebody's just listening now.
Sure. Well, again, no one on the healthcare team, no one who's working in the emergency room, or in the ICU or the operating room, is aware of somebody's registry status until we get to a point where there is no further recourse that can save their lives. And at that point, the discussion of the possibility of organ and tissue donation is introduced, and that's where the organ procurement organization, like Life Center Northwest, has a secure, you know, password-protected access to a electronic registry where we can actually do a search and see whether or not that individual had indicated prior to the death that they wanted to help others through the gift of life.
Great. So do you hear that? They don't know, so they will save your life if they have the chance.
Oh, I mean, even speaking from my perspective, I would far prefer that no one ever died and that everyone kept their own organs. I mean, that's the ideal world, but it's not the world we live in. And unfortunately, in spite of the fact that we have tremendously successful trauma care and health care in general in the United States, some situations are going to result in a death. Mm-hmm. And it's only in those situations, which we wish would never happen, but they do happen, that at least something good can come of that. In this instance, it's something good for other people, but the knowledge, the family is left with the knowledge that their loved one was able to help others at the time of their death. And that can be like gold for these families. We send letters to the families afterwards to let them know the outcomes, not in very detailed, specific ways, but let them know, thanks to your husband's generous gift of life, you know, there's a grandmother in on the West Coast who was able to take her children to whatever she might have, wherever
Disneyland.
Disneyland, there you go. But we'll meet these families. We stay in touch with these families, and they'll come up to you and they'll pull out of their wallet or their purse a folded up yellowed copy of a letter that they got 10 years ago to say, I carry this with me because it's a reminder that my loved one's death was not in vain.
I saw a video the other day, a family that their little girl had passed. She wasn't very old, 2 or 3, and they had made that hard decision. And the video was really about the family, but what I noticed was all the staff in the hospital and how they just came around that family. They didn't hurry them. When they took her down the hallway, all the nurses were standing
along the wall.
Along the wall, and I'd never seen anything like that, and I had to turn it off. I was just bawling. It was just, when I read your mission and when you said honor, I get goosebumps because that's what it felt like.
Yeah, that what you just described is what we refer to as an honor walk, and that's becoming very much a standard practice throughout hospitals throughout the United States, and it's an incredibly compelling and moving tribute to the patient who is going to the operating room to give the gift of life to others in need. And it's very helpful for the family members who oftentimes accompany the patient down the corridor to see that not only those that were caring for their loved one, but the entire hospital, those that are able to leave their post, will come down and line the walls. Sometimes we've seen, you know, several hundred people along the corridor on the way to the operating room. So honor walks are becoming increasingly commonplace, and it's a tremendous opportunity to truly honor the life of the donor and the gift that they're giving.
Because that's such an incredible gift. And I noticed on this video, there was a couple patients that peeked their heads out and they jumped in the line.
Right.
Somebody who was videoing was singing Amazing Grace. Now, I don't know if that was family or not, but you could just hear smatterings of it as they went along. And it was, this is the most terrible thing.
Right.
But here's the beauty of it. And it's that mixed emotions. Do you have counseling for families?
Oh, absolutely. And when we're in that, when we are there in a hospital setting with a family who is losing a loved one, we really recognize that we're walking on sacred ground. And the fact that the family is allowing us in to their, to this very personal, very intimate time in their life, we are tremendously grateful and respectful and caring and compassionate. And our focus is really on helping the families through that process. And in addition to that, so we have specialized staff, they're master's prepared staff who have expertise and education in working with families going through acute grief or in other emotionally charged circumstances in a compressed time frame. And but in addition to that, we have probably one of the best in the United States, what we call an aftercare program. So we have four or five now full-time dedicated staff there. I like to refer to them as angels on earth because they're so caring for these families for months and even years after the death of their loved one. So we stay in touch with the families. They become part of our community. We put on celebration events every year, two of them in Washington, one in Alaska, one in Montana.
Really?
And we have hundreds, in fact, we're approaching 1,000 now in Western Washington, of family members who come to celebrate the gift of life that their loved one gave. They're really, really beautiful, moving events.
Oh, that's
In fact,
awesome.
I'll make sure I send you the information so you can come to the one in Western Washington this year.
I would love that. Thank you.
Another thing that hospitals do to honor the donors and their families is they fly Donate Life flags on the flagpole outside of the hospitals. This, again, is becoming standard practice. And so if you're near a hospital and you see a flag that's flying outside on one of the flagpoles that says "Donate Life," that's in tribute to the memory of the patient who has died and who has given the gift of life to others.
Oh, that's so fascinating! What I was thinking about was if I, for instance, my family knows that I want to donate,
sure,
but it's going to be hard for them,
right?
You know, I mean, they'll do the right thing, but it's still hard. So right. It seems like that's kind of where the work is in, you know, helping them find the place where they can be really okay with.
Right. And one of the things we do to that exact point is that we provide every donor family with a quilt. We work with a group that does this for us at no cost. They make the quilts, and then we do handprints of their loved ones. So they have on the quilt, among other sort of squares that are just acknowledging the gift of life, there's also they're left with an imprint of their loved ones. Hand, and these families absolutely treasure these quilts. I mean, they're priceless to these families because it's a tangible, physical, memory of their loved one, and the fact that they were a hero at the time of their death.
Oh, I love that! I love that. So, how can people help? They can be a donor,
right? You can register to donate, and go to lcnw.org to do that. You can talk to your loved ones about your intent to donate at the time of your death, and you can encourage others to have those discussions and to be supportive of the efforts to increase the number of people who can donate and who can benefit from those gifts of life. Because there are, as I said, over 100,000 people today waiting for that phone call to say, your life will be saved. You'll have a second chance.
Do you take financial donations? You said you're a nonprofit.
We are a nonprofit. We don't have an active fundraising arm. We're not about making money, or we're able to cover our costs through our normal business model. And
wonderful.
For those that are interested in donating, I mean, on our website there is a channel for that, but it's not something that we actively pursue.
Okay, and one more thing. I could go for an hour. Do you have any kind of, like we have April where there's an awareness month, is there any kind of awareness programs or?
We try through social media, we try through our website, we try through every electronic means and other means to sort of publicize the fact that there is a huge need right now, and there will always be a need in this country and throughout the rest of the world. The rate at which people acquire diseases that need their organs to be replaced, will always exceed the rate at which people can donate organs to help those people. So it's a never-ending drumbeat. We like to say, like, we're climbing a mountain, but we'll never get to the summit.
No.
We just have to keep climbing. We have to keep putting one foot in front of the other and go. And so the more people that we can help that can join in that effort, mm-hmm. You know, the many hands make light work.
Right.
And we're all one big community here.
Yeah.
Many, they actually, there's recently a paper published this month that shows that the likelihood of somebody in the United States needing a solid organ transplant is 6 times higher than the likelihood that they would become an organ donor. So that just shows you that it actually, in terms of probability, you and I and everyone else are more likely to end up needing an organ transplant than to become an organ donor. So if we can all contribute by indicating our desire to donate at the time of our death, it helps the entire community elevate itself and increase the likelihood that those people in need of transplants will receive them.
And if you are on board with this, tell everyone you know. Encourage everyone you know, share this podcast, because just that's staggering that there's 100,000 people waiting for,
yes.
And that's just the United States.
That's correct.
Well, I can't thank you enough for being here. Thank you so much. And we'll look forward to having you in April and talk about this more. I'm Lori Hardy. Thanks for listening today. And we hope you've learned something. I know I have. Join us next week as we continue to talk with people that are making a difference in our community.